Hi everyone, it's so good to be back. And just before we get into today's episode, I just wanted to mention to you that today's episode has been brought to you by an incredible Irish company called counsellingonline.ie. I've used them before myself, long before we even got in contact with, you know, a view to working together on this podcast. But I used them during lockdown. And essentially what it is a counselling service that you can use online. And I love it. To this day, I do therapy online. And the reason I love it is because you can literally be in your pajamas. You don't have to go anywhere. You don't have to come out of a office and bump into someone. You don't even have to bump into your counselor or your therapist, but it's the handiness. It is every bit as effective to use it online. And I really stand behind this company. As I said, it's an Irish company. They're online since 2011. You have a huge choice and range of therapists to select from. So on their website, you can check out, you know, and find somebody who suits you. And if they don't work, you can pick another one. That's the beauty of it. So yeah, look, I really hope that you check them out if you feel that it's something that you need right now. On today's episode of Family Flowers Only, I speak to Amy Wall. Amy lives in County Clare and is a mom to three children, with one on the way, and wife to Vinny. In March 2017, 11 weeks after their second child Mannix was born, Amy's world was turned upside down when her husband Vinny and her three-year-old daughter Eslin were involved in a serious collision whilst they were on the way to creche. What happened is what I could only describe as a living nightmare. Amy talks so openly and honestly with me about the dark reality of child loss, how she gets through each day knowing another human is responsible for this, and how she has found a way to cope with the darkness. Amy, I've no doubt, will give so much hope to people who are struggling today. I hope you enjoy our chat. So hi, Amy.
Kathy.
How are you?
I'm all right.
We
How
meet
are you?
In person.
Finally, after
yes,
all these years.
We have spoke before.
Yes.
Yeah.
Face to face, but not.
Yes, it was in a more in private setting. Yeah, exactly. And you have, obviously, we'll be picking up from the gorgeous accent.
You are, it's nearly getting a bit too Claire yeah. now, according to my American friends
oh, really?
And family. Yeah.
They're having issues.
Yeah. Whereas my Irish friends and family would say I'm very American. So
you can't win.
No, I can't.
Your mixture.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you're originally from what part?
Michigan.
Oh, from Michigan.
Yep.
Cool.
Yeah. And I met my Irish husband in Portland, Oregon.
Okay.
And
I was going to say, I was thinking about last night going, how did you end up in Clare?
Yeah.
Did you meet him here or there?
So you met him there. So he has an older sister who's married to an American and they live in Portland. I had moved there after finishing university with a bunch of my hipster friends. And he came into the bar I was working in. And it was like, I mean, literally like the movies, love at first sight, I think.
No
for
way.
Both of us.
And really?
Yeah. We kind of kept the Skypes going as often as possible. We'd just have him on like in our houses and apartments for hours on end chatting away. And
so he was only on holidays?
Yeah, he was just there for like 2 weeks and I showed him around the town and we made out and whatever. And and yeah, he went back to Ireland. I was like, that can't be the end. And yeah,
we oh
just
my
kept
God.
Sweet, successful long distance. And yeah, I kind of forced his hand really into
do you know
marriage.
How many, you know how many times people have that dream and it never...
Exactly. Yeah. No, we're one of the lucky ones. Yeah.
Wow, that's
yeah.
so cool.
Yeah, I think we both were pretty sure of it pretty quickly. And he took a bit of convincing in terms of me feeling like I was ready to move to Ireland. He just was like, it's a completely different place. You've got to come stay here for a significant period of time before. And I did. So I came for like the full 90 days once. And I believe it was on the 87th day he proposed.
What, are you serious?
Yeah. And then we got married 3 months
oh
later
God,
back in
I
the States.
I love this.
Yeah.
So you moved here and you moved to Clare, County
yes.
Clare. Now,
yeah.
County Clare is one of my favorite parts of Ireland because it's so scenic.
Yes.
But it is super different.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I
did
mean,
you find that or did you just love
it? It's very rural.
It?
Yeah, my experience of Ireland would have been Dublin and Galway and, you know, these big cities.
Yeah.
And so it was very different, very rural. But it's his hometown. His family is very well known in the town. And I just was like welcomed instantaneously.
So you loved
you know,
it.
I've been like the lovable American blow-in. England, and I just have made the most incredible friends.
Wow.
Friendships I never thought I'd be able to make in adulthood in a foreign country with non-Americans. Yeah.
Like, it's, so you're happy.
Oh, right? I'm it's my home. It's my home. I'd never leave.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you and Vinny, obviously, he proposed to you on the 87th day of the 90.
Pretty much, yeah. I think I flew back to America like 3 or 4 days after he proposed. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I really left it to the final minute.
How long before you got married?
Just a few months, actually. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. You guys are such a love story. Love it.
Yeah, I guess.
I'm here for it.
We just, it was right. Yeah, we knew.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you guys got married in what year?
2010. October 10th, 2010, 10-10-10. I knew there was October no way he'd
10th.
Ever forget the anniversary.
10-10-10.
Wow. Yeah, I believe we were the minister's like fifth wedding that day.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That's wild, isn't
yeah.
it? And so obviously then, as plans go, and we all know plans mm-hmm. are, what's that saying? Show God your plans and he laughed or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, sounds about right.
But anyway, you guys had got married and then you obviously had said that you wanted to start a family.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We both knew that. I remember it actually was in Vinny's vows that he vowed to be the best father he could be. So yeah, it was always on the cards. And I have two younger sisters. They both beat me to it. And so I was pretty keen, like watching a niece and a nephew.
Yeah, wanted it.
Yeah, I was ready. Yeah. Yeah.
And so obviously you guys got pregnant then.
Yes. So we got pregnant with our first child. And she was born in March of 2013 and we named her Eslyn. She was born under the full moon. So we named her Eslyn Luna.
Love it.
And she just was an absolute delight from the first moment.
Tell me where you got her name from.
So she is named after my favorite American poet, a man named E.E. Cummings, Edward Eslyn Cummings. I'd always thought the name sounded very feminine. And I had a couple boyfriends before Vinny that knew if we had a child they would be, it was just the name, it was the name for
wow.
me. There was no other name. I just absolutely loved it so much. And his poem, which, you know, a lot of people probably in the grief community would be familiar with, "I Carry Your Heart, I Carried It in My Heart," it was just one of those things that I read it as a small child. And it was like instantly that just, I was like, oh, I love language. I love writing. Like, is this not the most beautiful thing? This came from someone's head and they put it down on paper and it's just.
I love that line.
It's just beautiful. The whole poem is absolutely beautiful. And when Vinny and I got married, actually, my sister, who's very musical, she set the poem to music. And that's what I walked down the aisle to.
Oh my God.
Was her singing this musical version that she wrote basically of "I Carry Your Heart." So it's, you know, it's had a
you.
Very pivotal yeah. role in yeah. my life. And I knew if I had a daughter, I'd name her Eslyn. And there she was. So
gorgeous. Tell me about Eslyn. What was she like when she was born? You had a good pregnancy with her?
I did. Yeah. Yeah. Everything was pretty straightforward. I had a pretty disappointing birth experience. I ended up with a section and it was quite traumatic at the time. She was just, you know, like once she was there, you kind of forget about all that. Yeah. Really, they're always worth it. And just, yeah, coming home with her. I mean, your first child, it's sort of like, no, nobody knows what they're doing, but we all put on airs,
yeah,
basically.
For sure, yeah.
And I don't know. I just, yeah, yeah. She was a great baby. She nursed very well. She slept here and there. She cooed. She, you know, she was beautiful.
The apple of everyone's eye then.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Vinny was
yeah,
obsessed.
Absolutely. And his parents in particular, like his siblings are all much older than him. And they all live kind of all over Ireland and then the one in the States. And so she was the first grandchild to be born in their hometown and be raised in their hometown.
So what a gift to them.
Oh, she was just
everything.
She was just the princess for granny and granddad. They just absolutely adored her. And aww. And yeah, they minded her for us all the time and took her on walks. And she'd do baking with granddad and granny. And yeah, she just, she was very spoiled by her granny and granddad.
It's gorgeous. And then in
2016,
yeah,
you decided to have company for ESLIN.
Yeah, so I actually had a pretty traumatic miscarriage in between ESLIN and
2015,
our next child. Yeah, basically it was Christmas Eve and ended up in the hospital and had to have emergency surgery, and it was very, very traumatic.
Yeah, it is. They're a huge loss.
Yeah, and I think especially when they're not straightforward. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I remember being put under sedation for the surgery and just thinking, like, I remember grabbing Vinny's hand and being like, I have to say bye to ESLIN first. Like, I could not imagine. I just knew, like, there's a possibility that I might never wake up again. Mm-hmm. I have to say goodbye to her. And, like, I'll never forget that feeling of just pure panic that
fear.
That could be it. Yeah. Yeah. So the recovery was very slow afterwards. I was, you know, I had to stay in bed for quite a long time. And then, you know, magically, we found ourselves pregnant again 3 months later.
Wow.
And the due date was basically just before Christmas the following year.
Wow.
So it was, you know, it was almost cathartic being back in the hospital a year later at the exact same time, but giving birth and also having a natural birth, which was incredibly healing for all of the previous kind of trauma. I think any woman who struggles with fertility issues and anyone who's gone through a traumatic labor and birth, to have another experience that ends up being what you had hoped it would be, it just really heals all those past wounds.
So special for you.
Yeah, yeah.
So then you welcomed Mannix.
We welcomed Mannix, yeah.
You guys are great at names. My God almighty, like.
Well, yeah, we're, for all the listeners, not necessarily the viewers, I'm now pregnant with our fourth.
Dying to hear this name.
We cannot.
You can't come
We
up
cannot
with a name.
Agree. Like, we are just completely different vibes this time around.
Like John or something.
Oh no, like no, Vinny's got just the craziest suggestions, and then mine are maybe a bit too trendy, and
it's actually very hard to name a
and
baby.
The pressure is there because we do have good names.
This is what I'm telling you. So you had Mannix.
We had Mannix, yeah. Okay. And we had decided to be surprised that time around.
So you weren't with ESLIN, you knew it was a girl.
Yeah, so we knew we were having ESLIN.
Okay.
And then with Mannix, we didn't know, was it going to be a boy or a girl? And I'm kind of getting ahead of in our story
but
ESLIN insisted it was a sister. She just was like, it's a girl, it's my little sister, and her name is Lucy, which was nowhere on our name list. Like, nowhere.
Doesn't
and we were just like,
criteria.
I don't know where she heard it. Like, but she just was like, yeah, she'd tell people, like, that's my little sister Lucy, and my mom used to tell me. And then Mannix came out, and I was so worried. I was like, it's not Lucy. Like, how is she going to react? And she just, it's like she completely forgot. And she just was besotted. Like,
really?
Oh my gosh. She just was obsessed with her little brother.
So she would have been about two,
yeah,
when
so
he was
she,
born?
She was 3.5. She was over 3.5. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Because he was born at the end of December and her birthday is at the end of March.
Wow.
So she was over 3.5. And
so
she was a little mommy. Like, anyone who has a little girl that age knows they just are like, what task can I do to care for this child?
Really?
Oh, yeah. She
like
wanted,
the maternal instinct.
Yeah,
to stay that
she'd
young.
She'd get home from creche and she wouldn't even say hi to me. She'd just be like, "Where's Mannix?" Like right in the house. She just wanted to see him, and she just absolutely adored him. Yeah.
So then I know a short time after that, Mannix was only a baby, and was it March 2017?
Mm-hmm. Yep. So on the 15th of March, Vinny was taking ESLIN to creche, and they were basically in a horrific car crash, and they both ended up in hospital, and I was at home with Mannix, you know. What, 11 weeks postpartum, you know, you're just
11
like,
weeks.
Yeah, you're still a total mess. And, you know, I'd hardly had anything to eat. I think I'd taken two sips of coffee and had a rough night with Mannix. I was absolutely exhausted. And there was a knock on the door. And it was my husband's friend's mom telling me there'd been an accident. And then there was a Garda there, and you know, it's like there's anyone who's gone through a sort of sudden trauma like that, there'll be certain details that are like so crystal clear, and then everything else is just like fuzz. Yeah. Like you can't kind of really grab onto it. I remember them saying Eslin and Vinny were on their way to the hospital. They were stable. That's all they knew. My friend's mom was suggesting she keep Mannix. And I said, he's exclusively breastfed. Like, he literally cannot be away from me for any, you know, period of time past an hour. And so my husband's friend showed up. He had actually happened to be one of the first people at the scene of the crash. And he drove us to Limerick Hospital. So we got to the hospital and they were kind of saying they're doing tests and they didn't really know what was happening. They had us in a room. By that point, I'd contacted Vinny's parents. So they were there, and they kind of put us in this private waiting room. And I remember the doctor coming back in with several other people. And that was my first sort of like, okay, this doesn't feel like good news.
Were you long there at this point?
Maybe 30 minutes or so.
Okay, so you just kind of
got there. Yeah, we hadn't been there too long. They said they had them both.
This all happened. When he left that morning mm-hmm. with you, mm-hmm. with Eslin.
Yeah, and I'd had a really bad night with Mannix. Mm. So I'd be downstairs helping in the morning, or she'd come upstairs and give me a bit of a cuddle before she went off to creche. And that day he didn't let her, because he knew I was sleeping.
Tired.
Yeah. And it's, you know, you always wonder why on those days is that, like, you know. So I didn't know what she was wearing. I didn't know what kind of mood she was in. Like, I didn't know any of that. I saw her the night before. I said, good night, I love you, and gave her a cuddle before bed. And that's the last time I ever saw her with her eyes open, basically. So
you get to Limerick Hospital, and this, you know, within 30 minutes, this guy is coming in with his team.
Yeah, and he's introducing me to a social worker. That's when I definitely knew something is bad here. And they said that they had been running a series of tests, you know, scans and all that kind of stuff on Eslin, and that basically, you know, blah, 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 Eslin will die. Like, that's all I can remember. That's all I can remember. I cannot remember anything else that was said. I can only remember those words. And just, like, I was holding Mannix. I remember Vinny's mom screaming. I remember seeing his friend, like, kind of fall against the wall. And I just was sitting there, like, staring at Mannix. And it's like you're watching yourself, but you're also experiencing it. But I just remember being like, focus on him, focus on him, focus on Mannix, focus on the baby, focus on the baby. Like, I just knew, okay, the world is blown up. When I look up, the world is going to look different around me right now. And the thing that's going to keep you going is this tiny human being that literally has nobody else.
So look down.
To survive at. So I just stayed kind of looking at him as they kept talking to us. And they said that they were going to transfer to Temple Street Children's Hospital in Dublin because they didn't have the facilities to keep her on life support in Limerick. I was a bit confused by that because it was kind of like, well, if she's dying, like, why are we keeping her on life support? And they're just like, you know, she needs to be in a facility where they are properly prepared to deal with her injuries. They can give you more detail. And they said, we're not giving you any kind of hope, but if she's going to live any more time, she has to be there, not here.
Okay.
So she had been flown to Limerick in a helicopter. No, sorry. Yes, she'd been flown to Limerick in a helicopter and then got another helicopter ride to Dublin, basically. And Vinny stayed behind in Limerick because he was also in a coma. So he was severely brain injured at that point. And
they obviously came in and told you this news also?
Yeah. So I got to go see both of them. They were both like together in this kind of like trauma bay room. And it was like right away, I knew I don't actually have the brain power right now to focus on Vinny. Like, mm-hmm. and I think he'd be okay. Mm-hmm. He'd be okay if I said, I'm just going to put all of my focus into Eslin right now. So I kind of spent like 30 seconds, like holding his hand and just saying, you know, you're going to be okay. Like, and I'm going to take care of her, and just like gave, you know, a quick chat in his ear, and then went to Eslin. And I pretty much like didn't really think about him that much mm-hmm. for the next few days because mm-hmm. I just couldn't. I did not have mm-hmm. brain capacity for like.
Yeah, and it's almost like the primal instinct of being a mother,
of course,
and her young,
of course,
you know.
And I know if anyone had done the same, of course, would have done the same thing.
It makes sense.
Yeah. So, she got shipped off in the helicopter. My friend drove myself and Mannix to Dublin. We showed up into Temple Street. Vinnie's older brothers arrived in. And there ended up kind of being the slow trickle of family. I had a couple girlfriends show up from Clare. They didn't even like call me or ask or anything. They just
were there,
drove and showed up in the hospital, and they never left my side for the next 4 days. I could not have done it without them. I had another friend do the same thing, but she flew from London. And she'd be my best friend from the States. And they showed up and they were just like this little team taking Mannix and making me cups of tea and just whatever they could possibly do, which, you know, is like, it's literally oxygen in a trauma experience. Like having someone just do something for you and not ask, they just do it. Like that's...
I guess your body has shut almost... Well, it's not your body, but like... You have shut down as a human.
Pretty much.
You're on power saving.
Pretty much. But I'm also like, oh, I still have to take care of this baby.
But they do it for you.
Yes.
Sort of carry you.
Yeah. Yeah. Like the amount of sleeps he had in the baby carrier on these three girls, you know, he just was being passed from one to one, and then he'd kind of be fussy and they'd be like, oh, he needs a bit of boob. And so it was like, okay, I'll breastfeed him and then pass him back. And I'd go back in and sit with Eslin and, so yeah, like once we arrived in, the doctors brought me in to see her, and she'd been kind of, you know, cleaned up a bit and you know, looked very lovely in her bed, and she was in this beautiful little room, and the nurses were just like, I can't imagine what it's like to be to work as a nurse or a doctor in, you know, like the ICU of a children's hospital. Like just the strength those people must have to do their job, it's unimaginable to me, really.
I can't imagine.
But they said quite quickly, you know, yeah, there's no hope here, basically. She is going to die. She's still showing some signs of life, so they couldn't like diagnose her as brain dead. So we kind of had to make a decision on how to move forward. And I was approached about organ donation. I just remember saying yes, like right away. Like that staring down at Mannix, it was like, okay, this is going to be a thing here. You can focus on this. You're not just going to like lose your almost 4-year-old child for no reason. Like she can maybe do some good here from this. And so that started the process of organizing how organ donation was going to work, if they were going to find matches and for whatever, and when would the surgery happen. I had family flying in from the States to say goodbye. I'll never forget my dad telling me he refused to pack. My family would be very religious, and I'm not very religious anymore, but my dad refusing to pack clothes for a funeral. And he said he prayed the entire time they were traveling, the whole flight, you know, all of it, just prayed and prayed and prayed. And you know, he said, I'm not going to my granddaughter's funeral. I'm not going there to go to my granddaughter's funeral. And obviously that was not what ended up occurring. But so they all showed up and everyone got to kind of have their time to say goodbye to her. And then it came time to take her off life support. And it's amazing, like the little things that you remember that really stand out from something that's like that traumatic. And when we were going down to this room where I was going to hold her and my sisters were going to be with me, And they were going to take all of the everything off of her, and she'd be unhooked from all the machines. And I said I had this little blankie from Manix. I had her her favorite taggy blanket, she called it, and then she had this little like purple stuffed baby doll, and she called them Baby and Taggy. So we had Baby and Taggy, a blanket from her brother, and then obviously I'm holding her, and I just like panicked. I was like, we need something from Vinny, we need something from Vinny. And my brother-in-law, who, you know, had flown in from the States, said we have a bag of some of his clothes in the hotel room that we're supposed to bring to his hospital tomorrow. And I said, we need like a shirt of his or something. He's like, I'll go get it. And he literally like stood up and ran full speed to this hotel that was, you know, not far from Temple Street, but a bit of a walk, ran full speed to get this piece of clothing to represent Vinny, and, you know, full speed back and got it to me just in time. And just how desperate people are when they're watching you go through something. Yeah. To like be useful.
Yeah.
And that was something he like instantly knew. He's a Marine. Well, he was a Marine. So it's like he knew. He's like,
perfect.
Give
guy.
Me a mission and I'm going to accomplish this. And he did. Like, and, you know, so we go into this room and they hand her over to me, and I've got all her little bits surrounding her. And my sister started to sing the I Carry Your Heart song that she had wrote. And, I just remember, yeah, like I just remember being like, wow, this is so beautiful. Like I was in it. I was doing it. I was holding her as she was dying, and I was listening to my sister sing to her, and I was looking at the nurses and doctors, you know, all just like, you could tell they were carrying the weight of how heavy this moment was, and to witness it and all of that. And I remember thinking, God, isn't this lovely? Isn't this a beautiful way for, like, you're so outside of, like, you couldn't really experience the reality of it in order to actually get through it. I had to, like, observe it almost.
Did you know that you were doing that? Like, did you
know? I knew I was doing it. I knew. Like, yeah. I knew what I was doing.
Yeah.
But, like, you can't really, how could you really comprehend what?
How could you step into
that means? Yeah. Yeah.
So you obviously were like, let's get this wall up to do what I have to do. It's like, it's almost like a, you become nearly like a robot.
Like, it was almost like I was kind of like in a movie for a minute. Yeah. Like, isn't this, like, who's directing this scene? It's really beautiful, isn't it? Like, all the little parts are just coming together to make this beautiful moment for Eslin to die. Like, it just, it was so, when I think back on it, I'm like, how in the world did you do that without, like, totally sobbing or screaming or, like, something? Like, I just think in order to survive it, I had to be like a step removed from it.
But also, I suppose, like, but up to this point, had you had any moment to break down?
I had, definitely. I had. There had been the last night. So she died on a Saturday evening. The Friday night in the hospital, the nurses said, you know, we can move her aside in the bed if you'd like to lay down and have a cuddle. And I was like, oh my gosh, I would love that. I would absolutely love that. So they kind of got her all like gently, you know, hooked to everything, moved aside and had the wires out of the way. And they let me lay down. I'm laying there and I got my arm around her and I'm holding her hand and I'm just whispering to her. And I started to hear this like kind of beep, and this beep is getting like louder and faster. And I look up at the monitors and her heart rate is just like going up and up and up. And I remember turning to the nurse and being like, what's going on? Is she okay? And she was like, you know, it must have been like, geez, at least midnight at this point. You know, I'm not sleeping. Like, I'm not eating. You're not doing any of the things your body needs you to do to function. Like, and she was just kind of like, maybe she's telling you to go rest. Tomorrow's going to be a big day. I'll never forget the nurse saying that to me. Like, and just thinking, like, is she trying to communicate something to me? Like, is she trying to say, you know, it's okay? Or is she trying to tell me she's scared? Like, what, you know, what is happening here that the moment my body is next to hers,
her
heart is responding to that? So I didn't cuddle long, because we kind of, myself and the nurse were both like, this, you know, we don't want anything
stress.
Yeah.
Body,
And I remember walking out of the room and just like, it was sort of the first bit of, is she still in there? from the last few days. And that just like broke me. And I remember going into the waiting area where my friends were, and my best friend Katie from London just like falling in her lap and sobbing. And I remember everyone else kind of leaving the room, and she just sat there quietly, and she stroked my hair, and she just let me sob. She didn't say anything. So like I definitely had moments of totally breaking down.
You've your other little baby there.
Yeah.
11 weeks old.
11 weeks old. Like, 11 weeks old, exclusively breastfed. Like, you know, still sleeping only a few hours at a time. Yeah. And no husband, no partner. Daddy wasn't there to help me do any of it. I mean, I was absolutely surrounded by people. They were all doing whatever they possibly could. But, you know, the other half of her wasn't there.
Yeah.
And he was in a coma. We had no idea what his diagnosis was. We still had no idea. Are we going to now go through this with Vinny? Like, we had no idea how he was doing. And his family were with him. We'd kind of separated. You know, they came and had their visits with Eslin, but they all tried to stay with Vinny as much as possible.
What a living nightmare, like.
Yeah, it really is. And, like, when I tell this story to people, or, you know, my friends or family that witnessed me go through it, like, everyone always will kind of say, oh, how did you do it? You must be so strong and all of that. And I just think any one of us would, you know, we're all going to have different reactions really to that. But like, yeah, exactly. Like, what do you do? You listen to the doctors, you listen to the nurses, you take care of your baby, you hold your daughter's hand. Like, what else do? You just do what you have to do to have those minutes and hours go by. Like that Saturday, I remember waking up that morning. And like, I've never had a feeling like it of just fear. Like, just, I was so afraid. From the moment I was conscious on Saturday morning, I had slept maybe a couple hours that night. And knowing today's the day we take her off life support, I just was like, how do I actually do this? Like, I know my child is going to die today. How do I do this? And how do I get to that point? So it's like, these are her last moments, her last hours. But at the same time, they are torture to like get through. So you're sort of like, okay, can this day pass, while also being like, I never want this day to be over. Like, it's, you're literally being pulled in like opposite directions and how you're going to try and get through it. And
you know, as you explained that there to me, it's like, you have a handful of hours, the most precious hours to you, available to you. But also, as each one of them passes, I totally get what you're saying. You're trying to slow it down, but also
you're like, this has to be done. This has to be over with. This wait for her to die. This has to be, like, I have to somehow just be done with it. My body can't take it anymore. Like, my brain can't take it anymore. Like, And so then there we are in the room, and I'm holding her, and my sister is singing to her, and a single tear falls down her face. I actually had to ask my sisters afterwards, did I see that? Like, one tear actually like come out of her eye? And they said, yeah, like she cried. Like, I can only think it was her saying goodbye, her saying she don't want to go, her saying I love you. Like, she was somewhere still in there, and she somehow understood what was happening. And like, there's no other, like, I don't know, maybe a doctor will call in and be like, well, actually. But like, in my head, I'm like, what other explanation could there possibly be to this? And
so
I remember not long after that, I kind of moved. Because it could be anywhere from a few seconds to a few minutes to a couple hours before they actually pass once you take the machines off. And I remember moving my hand over her heart. And I just was holding her like that in my hand, in my arms. And I had my left hand over her heart. And I felt it stop. I felt it stop. I felt a beat, another slower beat, and then nothing. I remember looking up to the doctor, and the doctor kind of like nodding his head at me. And then being like, okay, here you go. And just like handing her over and getting up and walking out of the room. I honestly don't know how they didn't like tear her from my arms, but I think that focus of the organ donation was so big for me that I was like, well, that's what has to happen next. This has to be successful. Like, I kept thinking of these people on the other end of the phone being told, you've got your life-saving organ, and then getting a call, oh, sorry, it's not going to work. Like, what is that like for these people? Like, and I remember the woman, the organ donation liaison officer, whoever she was, I remember her saying that so many times she's dealt with patients who it's their 10th, their 11th, their 12th call that they're getting this organ, and then it just falls through. Something doesn't work out. And so it was kind of this feeling of like, okay, here, take her, like get this going, like get, you know, this has to happen. This has to be something that happens and happens successfully. And thankfully it did. So she donated her lungs and her kidneys. Her lungs went to a little boy with cystic fibrosis, and her kidneys actually went to like a 60-year-old man on dialysis.
Wow.
I know, which like was kind of very similar to my dad's age at the time. And I remember just thinking like, oh my gosh, like somebody's granddad gets to have like a better life. Like, you know, you'd never think that a child's organs, and I'd say it's only particular ones really, can be used in adults. But yeah, so we didn't know that until later, I believe, exactly, you know, the type of people who get them. But we did know right away that at least the transfer was successful.
So, you know, it's just, you know, child loss is so, people are scared to even talk about it. Mm. Like they're terrified of it. Because it's really, 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 really difficult to wrap your head around that being you.
Yeah.
That being me, you know, to be the mom sitting there with their 3-year-old, almost 4, and letting her go. Like, it's really difficult to imagine. And so when you tell me, I'm like, that makes sense. Just, okay, like, right, can't be there.
Yeah.
This is what has to happen.
Yeah.
But obviously, you know, that day and it's a success. And then again, you know, you have to get through a funeral.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was like the next day waking up, and my family were, we all stayed in the same hotel, but I had my own room, and they took Manix for me that night to just see, you know, how much can we at least let her sleep as long as physically possible before he wakes her up. And yeah, I remember waking up and going and having like buffet breakfast in the hotel, and then being like, oh, I need something to wear to a funeral. Like, I don't have any, like, I just had a baby a few months ago. Like, I don't have anything suitable that fits me or anything like that. And I'm going to be breastfeeding. So like, it needs to be like breastfeeding accessible. And just right away being like, oh, this is a task I have to complete now. You know, this is day one of the after. And that's the thing I'm doing first is finding a dress.
What did you think the people around you were thinking? Do you think that they were all really, really worried about you, or just like, it's, you know?
Oh, I'm sure they were. But like, I have always been able to kind of still have like moments of humor and like that. And I think it is actually a coping mechanism for sure. And I think it was also a protective measure for my friends and family. Like, I was like, oh, if I just keep acting like myself, then everyone else is going to be okay. But if I like have a total mental breakdown, then like, how's that going to affect everyone else? So you just kind of try and keep going through it.
Is that who you are as a person? Worrying about other people?
Yeah.
Because I mean, I'd be expecting the mental breakdown. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, I just, I don't know.
You were worried.
It's almost like you're putting on this, like all of a sudden I had this role that I had to play. Okay, now I'm the grieving mother. So how do I go about doing that to the appropriate measure without looking like a total psycho, but also, you know, without being a total weirdo about, you know, still maybe cracking jokes here or there, or like actually laughing at something or whatever. Like, and just being very aware that now I am sort of, I'm like the star of this show now. Yeah. And everybody is going to be like
watching you. Yes, almost. Yes. That's what I mean. Almost. It's like, what was everyone around you? I'm sure. Like, so I guess you felt that you're like, oh God, like, how do I act here? Because everyone's.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
But obviously, no matter what you look like on the outside or the, you know, on the inside, yeah, you're clearly broken.
Yeah. And I think anyone who has lost a loved one suddenly, I think in particular, something like a car crash, right? It is violent. Mm. It is a very awful way to go. You know, maybe you're lucky enough to kind of die instantaneously, but not everybody has that experience. So there's pain. The way that their crash went, I always worry that she was scared, that she was very scared, because basically a truck pulled out from behind a bus to attempt an overtaking maneuver without properly being able to see that Vinny was coming in the oncoming lane. And all of a sudden there's a truck coming head on to Vinny in his lane. And so he swerved to avoid a head on collision. That caused him to lose control of the car, and he went across the lanes of traffic, and the car, a car, two cars behind the truck hit Esslyn's door directly. So there would have been a few seconds there where was she, did she understand that like daddy didn't have control of the car anymore? The spinning, how violent was that? Like, there is so much in that sudden loss of, and in such a traumatic way like that, that you actually are not capable of really comprehending everything surrounding, you know, the awfulness of that. Mm-hmm. I think our brains are very good at protecting us in those kind of experiences, like how I was behaving when we took her off life support. I think, you know, it really was a good year before the shock wore off. So those first few days of being
total shock,
you know, she's just died. Now we're waiting for this funeral and we still don't know what's going on with Vinny. Like, yeah, it's you're literally doing what you can to function. Yeah. And that's pretty much it.
And that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Because there's no manual.
And I was surrounded by people taking care of me and doing all of the tasks and whatever. And, you know, putting Mannix to the breast and taking him away. And then like just doing all the things that they could possibly do for me. And our town, you know, Ennis Diamond really came together for us and did everything they could to help. I was sort of like, okay, we're not religious. We don't go to the church, Catholic or Protestant. Like, what, you know, how do we have like a funeral for a child? And there was this kind of old building in town that was used for functions. And one of my very good friends just was like, I've got this. And like, she just planned everything and she got everyone together and they decorated the place. They made it look like this fairy woodland, magical kind of, like, it just was absolutely stunning. And like, everyone came together to decorate and donate decorations and flowers and balloons and whatever. And she, you know, she helped contact the minister who like did the service. She organized who was going to speak at when, and she just took, like, I don't know how I would have done that. I don't know how, like, I couldn't have done any of that. I couldn't
Good
have done
for
any
her
of that.
For having the,
but that's the courage thing in to grief, like too. That exactly. Mm. That's who you need. Like this the same doers. Friend, almost a year later, called my GP and said, "Amy is not functioning. She needs to come in and see you." Like, some people might think that's going too far, but like, I really wasn't. I wasn't functioning. And she made a call that some people might end friendships over something like that. Mm-hmm. And she was like, Amy's not capable of actually making this call herself because she's trying to stay strong and do everything for her family. But I can see she's not functioning. She needs some extra help right now. I'm calling her GP.
That's amazing.
Like, yeah.
Because it takes courage.
Exactly.
To step up.
Exactly.
But you got to... Yeah, kind of have to say to yourself, well, if they hate me for it, fine, but I'll take the
risk.
But
maybe this is the thing that turns something around for them. And it was, like, it definitely.
As you tune into today's meaningful conversation,
We at Counselling Online are so delighted to support and sponsor Grief Ireland. Grief is a complex emotion and we all cope in our own ways. If you find yourself seeking a safe, confidential space to share and explore your feelings, Counselling Online is quietly here for you. Our motto is, wherever you are, we are. Should you feel like reaching out, we are only a click away. www.counsellingonline.ie. Take your time and be well.
So you say goodbye to Eslin, and all the while, Vinny is still in a coma?
Yeah. So he actually, they kind of stopped the coma medication that keeps you sedated. And he sort of first kind of fluttered his eyes open on the day of her funeral. I remember thinking that was very sort of like, you know, there's something in him that's now like stirring him awake.
Yeah.
And it's all of us like saying goodbye to her on the other side of the country. And so just a couple of days after we buried her, then I went back to Dublin with my parents and, you know, to go see him awake for the first time. And we were told that, you know, he could be any number of ways waking up, but that we knew for sure he was not going to have any comprehension of what had happened. So there was to be no mention of the fact that there had been a car crash, that Eslin had died, any of that. Because the short-term memory is like not there at all when you're waking up from a coma. So you could be given like the most devastating news. You go to bed that night, you wake up the next day, you've completely forgotten it. So the doctor said, you can't, like, don't, you know, there's no mention of it yet. You're just going in there, you're visiting him. Like, he might not even be able to, like, talk to you or say anything to you, or you might not understand him. You might not even know who you are. Like, there's no way to know how someone's going to wake up from a coma. But he did know who we were. Remember, I walked into the room and he called me American Amy.
Did he used to call you that?
No, of course not. I mean, I was his wife.
What did you say? Hi, he American
was,
Amy.
Yeah, he was just like, it's American Amy.
Oh.
Yeah.
I thought it was like a nickname or something.
No. It was just like how his brain like yeah, was like,
putting it together.
Who's that person? Oh, yeah. That's Amy from America.
Oh, my God.
And like he did very, very well, kind of like straight away. He, you know, it wasn't nearly as scary as the doctors.
I was just going to say, were you scared going in there?
I was very scared. Yeah. I was very scared. I was very scared that he could end up, you know, permanently brain injured in some way where, you know, like the worst way possible. Could he be in a wheelchair for the rest of his life? Would he ever communicate again? Would I end up being responsible for taking care of every aspect of his life? Am I capable of doing that after bearing a child? Like, it's, you know, all the worst case scenarios go through your head. And it was actually the day after we first saw him was Eslin's birthday. She would have turned 4. And I remember, you know, being by his bedside and holding his hand. And he's not, you know, he wasn't really, he can't really look at you. He wasn't really communicating much. He'd mumble stuff. He was randomly speaking Irish words. Like, I remember the nurses being like, does he speak Irish fluently? I'm like, no.
Wow.
But that's where his brain turned on. Like, his brain turned on when he was learning Irish, basically, as a child.
Isn't that just crazy?
Yeah.
The brain is so...
Oh, my God.
Like, it's everything.
Yeah. But I remember leaving the hospital and being like, it's her birthday. Like, how... I can't... There has to be something. I have to do something. And I went into, like, a Tesco and got, like, the girliest cake I could see in, you know, the crappy ready-made cake aisle. And some candles, and brought it back to the Airbnb we were staying at with my parents. And my brothers-in-law happened to be over to have a chat with us. And the man who would end up becoming our solicitor was there. And we lit candles and we sang happy birthday to Eslan, and we had cake. And it just was like the strangest thing in the entire world.
The worst.
Yeah. Yeah. But back in Clare, like everyone we knew went to her grave and had a little birthday party, and they sent me pictures, and it just was absolutely incredible. They had the place full of balloons and bunting, and people brought cake, and the kids were running around playing, and you know, they just they've never forgotten her, our community, like ever, ever, ever.
No.
And that is the most amazing gift. Like.
And so Vinny was in Limerick still? Mm-hmm.
No, so he had been in Limerick. He was transferred to Dublin and then transferred back to Limerick.
Oh, wow.
Then from there, he ended up in the rehabilitation hospital. But it would have been 5 weeks to the day of the crash. Well, it was actually the weekend before was Easter. And we'd gone to visit him, myself and his sister. And he started to talk about how he feels like he had been really trying to figure out why he was there. Like really trying to figure it out. He was using up way too much brain power trying to figure out, why am I in the hospital? Why do I feel fuzzy and weird and whatever?
And he couldn't even probably put that together, could he?
No, no, he had no memory of it. He has no memory of the crash whatsoever.
No, but I'm saying, when was he able to be like, was he starting to go, why am I here?
No, he knew. Yeah, he knew. Like he was like, that. He knew he was in a hospital. He tried to escape a couple times, which was actually quite funny. But he had no wallet or phone or anything. And he'd be found like wandering another part of the hospital or whatever. They'd get him back to his ward. But I remember it was Easter Sunday, and He just casually said something about, I thought of a way that could really help my brain get better. I can go home and I can read books to Eslan, because she really loves when I read books to her. And I remember just like looking at him in the eyes and being like, like, what do I say to that? What do I say to that? And the feeling of like that was a lie to me. I lied to his face in that moment. The feeling of that was like soul crushing. Like, and I remember saying to Anna, like, that's his sister, like, we've got to tell him. I can't keep doing that anymore. And right before we were about to leave, he said something like, I keep thinking, like, what if I had been in a car crash? I might have been in a car accident, and sometimes when I'm in the car, I'm with Eslan. And it's like somehow he knew, even though he
coming back.
Yes, he has no memory of any of it whatsoever. He doesn't even remember like the few days leading up to the crash, which we had done things out of the ordinary on those days. He has no memory of them whatsoever, but there was something in him that was like telling him, be prepared here. And so it was a few days later that we went back to the hospital, his parents, his siblings, me. And we had decided, obviously, that I'd be the one to say it. And like that memory of that fear was so similar to that fear of waking up that Saturday to take her off life support. It was like the exact same feeling. He's still safe in this other world. And now I'm going to pull him into the new one where his first child doesn't exist anymore and he didn't get to say goodbye. And he was the one driving the car. And he'll always, even though he'll be told over and over and over again, you could have done nothing, it wasn't your fault, he's always going to have survivor's guilt. And he does. He absolutely does. And he will always have that. And having to walk into that room, like I thought I was going to like vomit everywhere. I couldn't eat it all that day. I just was like sick to my stomach that was the day that he was gonna have to be pulled into the after with us. And that's what we did. And he had a very brain injured reaction. He said, wow, that's tough. And he said, was I speeding? And we kind of reassured him, no, it wasn't your fault at all. It was completely out of your control. We talked a bit about it, and then I asked him if he wanted to like be with his mom, or did he want to go have some private time with me, and he said with you. So we went back into his room, and the first thing he said when the door shut behind us was, well, I guess we have to have more kids. Like, it just, you know, how his brain so newly injured, you know, 5 weeks post massive trauma, was trying to already like move him forward somehow, was just such a like show of what a resilient person he is.
Mm.
And just how, yeah, like right from the start, he was kind of like, I'm going to get through this somehow. And maybe the way that we do that is by not replacing Eslin, but yeah, bringing joy back into our home again somehow.
Do you think he grasped it in that moment? That he fully
understood? I don't
really
think so. Mm. No, I don't really think so. And you know, I'd really only say it's recently that I've kind of seen his grief a bit more.
Mm.
I think the first 3 years, like, he wasn't really able to tap into it.
But it's like everything was messed up. It's like his reaction to that, going, oh, that's tough. It's like, that's not how he would react in a million years.
No.
So
no.
It's like it wasn't him as a personality reacting. It was this brain has now confused everything, that the emotion is detached almost.
Yeah.
And like, oh, wow, that's tough.
Yeah.
That's not what you would normally say.
No.
So it's like it wasn't even him. It was just this brain that he had.
Yeah. And I knew that was a possibility. I knew, you know, that it could go any number of ways, but that a very muted reaction was very highly possible.
That must have been really hard for you.
I struggled with his grief for a very long time.
Yeah.
For a very long time. And I often described it as we both lost the same child.
Yeah.
We lost her in completely different ways. Mm-hmm. He was actually in the car with her and has been left with a permanent brain injury, but has no memory of any of it. And I had to go through every moment of it on my own without him. Like, I think most couples would not have been able to, I don't want to say most, but I'd say there'd be a lot of couples that would struggle to find a way to support each other, having gone through that experience in such completely different ways.
Yeah. It's like unsurvivable.
Yeah. Like he would have been in hospital for 3 full months. So like we only had Mannix, you know, for 3 months before the crash. And then the 3 months after that, Vinny wasn't even in the house with us. And then he was back. And you're kind of like, you know, what's next? Like we're doing everything we need to do to take care of a baby. But then you're just kind of sitting around staring at each other. Like I remember like just hours would go by and we wouldn't even like, we wouldn't talk or really do anything because it was like we both just were completely stunned that here we are. And
this
house that used to be like full of this noise of Eslin. And now it's just like completely silent, you know. And I remember being so struck. I actually wrote a poem about it in the beginning about how quickly those norms change. And I'd say anyone who's had a sudden loss like that, where someone's literally in the house one day and then they are never return. And it was like, I'm like running the dishwasher once a week because it's literally just me making dishes, you know. I'm brushing my teeth and I'm staring at like his toothbrush and her toothbrush. And her last bath, I had never like tidied up all of her bath toys and stuff. So like the water drained out of the tub. And then like the next day there was a car crash and no one was in the house for the next week, basically. And we came back and I remember seeing all of her toys like in the tub with her bathwater still in it. I didn't touch that stuff for like 3 months. Like I was watching it, like literally watching it slowly evaporate from her toys. And I'd stay, like I didn't even use that shower. We had a different shower. I just was like, I can't even, like this is one of those still lives that is, this was the before. And now like if I change it, I'm saying that's it, you know, she's gone.
It's like time stood still.
Oh, completely. Like there were like,
you were there.
But like altars or tableaus, whatever you would call it, like around the house that just, I could not change. A pack of yogurts I bought the night before at the grocery store that were like a new flavor that she'd never tried before. I literally only threw those out like last year.
That makes sense.
Because it was just one of those things. I saw them in the fridge every time I opened it. Those were for Eslin. And I just couldn't like.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I feel like people who aren't in the active process of grieving, you know, every day, I call it like perpetual grievers. Like I will, you know, I'll grieve for her for the rest of my life. It's my job. It's basically my job now, pretty much. They'll understand those little things like that, that if you said it to someone who hasn't gone through an extreme sort of tragic loss like that, they'd be like, what a weirdo. You kept a pack of yogurts in your fridge for 5 years.
Did you expect a reaction? That I was like, yeah.
No, exactly. Like, you're like, no, that's perfectly normal. Like, I can imagine people listening to this and being like, oh my gosh, that's my husband's shirt that I refuse to, you know, move from his side of the bed or any of that kind of stuff. Like, it's just one of those things that you're just like, I'm going to hold on to that. Yeah. I just want to hold on
but
to
it,
that.
But it almost feels like if you were to pick them up that you're throwing it out.
Exactly.
And it's like, why? No.
Leave
the yogurts in the fridge. It's not hurting anyone.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I get that.
I saved some for bathwater. I bought this pretty jar.
That's lovely, actually.
And I saved it. Mm-hmm. And I like, it's, you know, when I think about it, I'm like, is that not just the weirdest thing, her dirty bathwater? But it's
no,
like
it's not.
There are cells of her in that water.
But it's to say like people cut off locks of hair. It's
yeah.
Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah. And
did you, when you sat there in those moments and as you said, you were like stunned. Obviously, I just want to ask for, you know, the reality of it all. Did the grief, that heavy, 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 did it come and did it settle on
absolutely.
You?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in the beginning, it scared the hell out of me.
Really?
I had a plan. If it was too much, I could go jump off the cliffs. They're 10 minutes away.
Really?
Yeah. I knew like, I figured, okay, you know, Mannix would be devastated, but perhaps when he was older, he'd understand, you know, and that maybe I probably would have done the same thing if it had happened to him and not her. Like, I just, the pain becomes so intense. And I know anyone who is grieving the loss of a very close loved one, particularly a child, a parent, a spouse, sibling, the pain can be so physical. Like, so physical. I remember that, like, the sensation of literally wanting to, like, rip my skin off.
Wow.
Like, I want to, like, get to my heart somehow and, like, pull it out because this is too much. Mm. I can't take it. And the exhaustion that comes from that, like, that first year, I went back to bed every day. I got up when Mannix got up, take care of him. Make us food, you know. I ate regularly. I went for walks. Like, I watched shows. I hung out with friends. You know, I did all the normal stuff. But, like, I'd get to a particular time of day where it was, like, bedtime. And I had to just turn off for a few hours. Like, my brain couldn't manage the whole day.
Mm.
And I had to take a break. And I had friends coming and going all the time. It was amazing that one friend I mentioned who organized the funeral, called my GP, she actually had like a rota of AM and PM shifts of my friends. I could call them off if I didn't want anyone by or if I didn't need anyone. Otherwise, I'd have a friend in the morning and a friend in the evening show up. They could bring food. They'd take Mannix for a walk. They'd do dishes. You know, they'd just sit and chat.
You needed that though.
Oh my gosh. Like, particularly when Mannix or when Vinny was still in the hospital. Like,
but the important thing is there as well, as I was saying again, it's the courage of that friend and those friends to step in, because some people are afraid of the reaction or they might want me and maybe they would be like, get the F out of my house.
Yeah.
But to have the courage, like, to see that, I don't know, would you have been, as you said, your brain couldn't even do a full day's life.
No.
It had to just go.
I had to take a break.
So therefore you needed the help.
The other stuff done. Mm. Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. And, you know, everyone reacts differently in grief. And I think some people, they find a lot of help by continuing to do their tasks, continuing to do the normal stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's what gets them through it. That's perfectly okay too. That doesn't mean you're coping any better than anyone else.
Yeah.
You know, we all figure out our way to survive it. And that's all you really can do, I think, in that first year or two of loss, is just survive it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When the just the darkness of it all,
I actually called it my cave.
Okay.
I'd go into the cave.
When it got bad.
Yeah.
Bad. Like, did you not want to be here? You say you had that plan.
Oh, yeah. I'm not a religious person anymore.
Mm. Yeah.
I have not felt Eslin. I haven't, like, you know, I haven't really seen signs, anything like that. There's a part of me that thinks, because she was so young, I have a really hard time finding any happiness from the thought of her existing somewhere else without me being able to take care of her. It just, yeah. I don't know. I just, when I think of an afterlife, I can't imagine this little 4-year-old in it and what it's like. And does she understand? And is she alone? Like, who would she have known when she got to heaven? Like, what, like, it was never, something that really gave me any comfort. So I knew that in the loss of a child, there's really never going to be any end to this pain. And I knew I'd been told by other people further down the road that it does, you get better at it. And I can attest to that 6.5 years on. You absolutely get better at grieving. It doesn't get any easier, but you get better at doing it. And I found that the darkness was sort of like, it was so bad that I knew I'm going to feel like this forever. Mm-hmm. I'm not all the time forever, but like forever, I'm going to feel like this forever.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way that that's ever going to end is when my life ends. So if it gets bad enough, that's an option. And when that does happen, either I'm not going to be in pain anymore, or I'm going to be with Eslin. It's like one or the other. Either I'm going to have no consciousness whatsoever, and so no more pain, no more questions, no more anything. Or I'm going to suddenly, like, be with her. There's a draw to that when you are really in the darkest depths of your grief. There's a draw to that. Absolutely.
Hmm. And so how did you survive? How are you still here?
Manics. Absolutely manics. Yeah. And
baby got you through.
Yeah. Like we said, she was our moon and he was our sun. And he had no idea. Like, he had absolutely no clue what had happened in his life. And, you know, he's going to be 7 this December. And I think we're starting to see some effects of that trauma and that traumatic childhood for him. He was not raised at all in a normal household.
Mm-hmm.
He was raised by a brain injured dad and a severely traumatized mother. We've always displayed very big emotions in our house, and he has a lot of difficulty regulating emotions. But at the time, he was just a little baby, and then he was a toddler learning how to do everything. And that's like the best age ever because they're just hilarious. They're like little drunk adults, basically, and they just crack you up all the time. And he just like right away, he became that lifeboat for us. And like, I can't wait for the day that he'll hopefully understand that.
Mm-hmm. Be interesting, won't it, to just hear his take on things when he's an adult?
Yeah.
What age is he now?
So he'll be 7 at the end of December. And then a few years ago, we decided we were ready to add on to the kids that Finian mentioned in the hospital that day. And we got pregnant again right away. We were very lucky. And I knew absolutely I wanted to find out what we were having because I knew I wanted a girl. And I didn't even want like a moment of sadness on the day that they were born. So we said we'd find out. And we found out it was a girl. And the only name she could possibly have was Lucy.
I was just going to say, and you called her?
And we called her Lucy. Yeah. So that's her sister named her.
She was named by Eslin.
She was named by Eslin. Yeah. Yeah.
So special.
Yeah. Yeah. And they both mention her at least once a day. Like, and it's absolutely incredible. Like, Lucy's going to the creche now that Essen was at. And I was getting her out of the car the other day and she said, "Oh, I wish Essen could meet my Danielle," who's her teacher. And I just was like, you know, they're thinking about her all the time, even though they literally have no memories of her. They have no memories of her. But they are fully aware that there's another family member, that they have a big sister. They talk about their big sister. Just this morning, Mannix said, "Oh, I wish Essen could have seen this movie with us," when we were talking about a movie we had seen recently. And I feel like that is like the greatest gift I can like give her. Like that's like the most honorable thing I feel like I can do in my grief, because when we talk about them, we're breathing life back into them.
Keeping her alive.
So she died in 2017, but she has literally been in our family every day since. We've talked about her every single day. Her pictures are everywhere. Like her stuff is still out. Like Lucy's so funny because she's wearing like the last clothes Essen wore. She's now that age.
Wow. And
so she's wearing the last clothes that Essen wore. And like she just happens to love the same exact dresses that were Essen's favorites. And I'll say to her, I'll be like, "Oh, you know, Essen really loved this dress too." And she'll go, "Yeah, but it's mine." She's just like,
"Oh, this
is Essen's favorite My Little Pony. It's mine now." Like, you know, but it's just, they somehow, these two little kids who like, you know, one of them met her, but was literally a baby
weeks,
and the other has never met her. They miss her in the way that they can. And like how special that is to be able to still have her like with us every day in that way. Not the way that we'd want her to be there.
No.
But in really the only way she can be there now. And that's just in our memory. And even Lucy will walk around and say, "She's in our hearts. We keep her in our hearts."
Really? She says
oh,
that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, she parrots the stuff that I say. Because, you know, kids, they're so factual.
But that's the whole, I carry you in my heart.
Yeah.
And it's Essen, and that's her name. And it's like, to hear
like,
come out of that child's mouth.
Like, kids are so.
She was named by her.
They're really, they can be very jarring, I think, for adults, because they'll just state the facts. Like, Essen died. Essen's dead. My big sister's dead. Like, it's just like, it's a fact of their life. It's their reality. And you know, they'll say it kind of out of nowhere sometimes. Mm. And I'll be like, "Yep, she is. Yeah, she did die. But, you know, we keep her in our hearts." That's what I just would always say to them. And now they parrot that back to me. And it's just... yeah, it's the most special thing. And I've struggled with how will it play out in the long term?
Yeah.
How will they look back on that loss, how their parents dealt with it, how it shaped them?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think about this one event and it's literally going to be the thing, particularly Mannix. I feel like it's shaping him, who he will be as a person. He will be shaped by the fact that at 11 weeks old, his sister was killed in a horrific car crash.
Of course.
And how that affected who his parents were and how he was parented.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really heavy burden to carry.
But it's the knock-on effect of grief. It's not just straightforward. It's like, it's the ripple effect, isn't it? Like his life has been affected.
Yeah.
Out of your control, out of everyone's control. But one thing I wanted to touch on again was... you know, you then had to face into a legal battle.
Yeah. Yeah.
And obviously, you know, whatever you want to mention on that, but just to say, you know, this was all caused by the reckless driving of another person.
Yeah. So there's literally one person to blame.
That's
and
hard.
I think, you know, like someone who's a victim of a crime, or, you know, they lose someone to murder or something like that. You know, it is a different type of loss than you know, like, oh God, I can't imagine sitting by my kid's bedside watching them slowly die from an illness or something. Like, I can't imagine that at all. But to be able to look at somebody and say, "You are solely responsible for the nightmare that is my life now," it is a very scary amount of rage. And that has been one aspect of my grief that I have perpetually struggled with because I have no outlet for it. I have no outlet for it. We have not gotten any kind of justice. It was, you know, so many different details and experiences in the courts over the years. But basically, he was charged with dangerous driving, causing death and serious bodily injury. He pled down to careless driving, causing death and serious bodily injury. In the court, even after he pled guilty, his barrister still argued that potentially it was the bus driver that pulled out into traffic first and that the truck just followed him because maybe there was a pedestrian in the road or a rock or something. They still were making excuses, like even after pleading guilty, he never fully took the blame. I remember reading our victim impact statements and like what that was like to sit there and say all of these words to this man. And he just stared at the floor the whole time. He never once made eye contact with us. He never once spoke any word of remorse throughout the entire process. And for some reason, the judge felt a bit of sympathy towards him. He would have been in his 60s, a professional driver for most of his life. Hadn't killed anyone before, so I guess, you know, not that big of a deal maybe. And he lost his license for 4 years, which is the actual bare minimum sentence you can get for that kind of crime. And he had to pay a fine of €750 for Eslin's death, €750 for Finney's injury. I remember when he was initially charged thinking, God, the irony if he got a jail sentence of 4 years and that's all like Eslin got on earth. And then he didn't even get that. He just got his license taken away from him for 4 years. So immediately the DPP appealed anyway, and they had a successful appeal. And the appeals court added on an 18-month sentence, but fully suspended. So really nothing. It's, you know, it's just... It's,
I don't get that.
No,
shit.
It doesn't mean... It's like, okay, great, so nothing.
You get it, but you don't get it.
Yeah, and they're like, oh, well, if he offends again, then he's going to jail. And it's like, right. What?
So yours didn't matter.
Yeah, so that one didn't matter. But if he doesn't listen to his punishment, then that's the bit that matters.
It's really upsetting, isn't it?
The whole court system. Like, I feel for anybody that has to go through that process, because it's, especially if it's over the death of a loved one, like you're not getting anything back, and you're not getting anything that's even remotely close to what you've lost. But to have it actually feel offensive, like that her life didn't even matter, that is a particular added part to our grief that has been incredibly difficult for Vinny and I to deal with. And just last year, no, earlier this year, this is the grief timeline. You can't even like properly remember when things happen because they're so dramatic. You're just like, yeah, I'm not going to deal with that anymore. He successfully got his license back early. So he approached the court and requested to have his license reinstated because he needs to work to make money. So he needs to do the job that he did when he killed somebody. And apparently there's no other work that he can possibly do. Also, apparently he is sick and needs to get to medical appointments and cannot rely on taxis for that. And a different judge sympathized with him. And I think the thing that hurt the most in that whole process is we found out later that that judge had also experienced the loss of a child.
Wow.
And I could not figure out how he could sit in that courtroom and know he was adding on so much pain to our loss, a loss that he understood, by choosing to put this man out on our roads, my road that I'm going to be driving all the time. He's going to be on those roads again. Even after all of that, all of this leniency and everything, we still feel like it maybe was a bit too much of a burden for him for the crime that he committed of taking the life of a child. Obviously that's like years rolled up into about 5 minutes there, but like it's the process of it is just like when we read our victim impact statements, COVID had literally just hit Ireland. So we went into that and weren't able to like touch anybody afterwards or hug anybody or anything like that. We had loads of people show up to support us, but like that whole process was happening in such a strange time anyway. And then we gave birth to Lucy like 2 months later, and just like the roller coaster of emotions that you get put on as a grieving person, and then like a grieving person in the justice system, and just it's
an extra layer.
It's an extra layer that you don't really have any good way of dealing with it. Like it's part of it that I've kind of put in a box.
Yeah.
And I have to leave that box on a shelf. Yeah. Because if I tapped into that anger,
where do you put it? Wherever it would go, it wouldn't be towards the right.
No, I would be a really bad person if I let myself go to that that part of the darkness, because I am not a violent, angry person, but I am when I think about him, when I think about how easy it would be for him to just have said, I'm so sorry I was impatient that day. I think about her every day. Any chance at expressing remorse that he had, he refused to take. And even the day that he was granted his license back, he had to take the stand, which he never did in the entire process. And the judge asked him directly, you know, the loss of a child, like, you have to be sympathetic towards what the Wall family have experienced. You know, do you have anything to say to them? And he just mumbled something about the loss of a child is very hard, but I've been driving for 40 years. And even in that moment, he had the perfect, even if he didn't mean it, right? Like, even if you don't mean it, you think, how, as another human being, can you sit there and not just turn and look at us and just say, I really regret that day?
That's crazy. There's no remorse at all.
No remorse. We've never seen an ounce of remorse from him. I just think we crossed paths with a genuinely bad human being. But if I continued trying to get that from him, I'm only hurting myself in the process.
For sure, for sure.
So I've put him in a box, and I put that box in a closet. I don't open that closet, basically.
You're right. It's really upsetting.
Mm.
It's really hard to fathom how, even if you thought, I didn't mean it, you would still apologize.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
Let's leave it in the box.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's again, as I said, it's such a huge, tremendous amount. Like your whole life. Do you ever sit on some days and daydream about, you know, what your life could have been like? Even when it comes to Vinny and everything too, and all you went through, like, or again, is that fruitless?
It's a strange one, because I think any parent who's lost a child would say they would do anything in a moment to get that child back. I feel that, but at the same time, I think, would we have Lucy? Would I be pregnant right now? I can't change it. I can't. There's nothing I can ever do to change what we've gone through in our lives, and thinking in that way is just so unhealthy.
Yeah.
I talk about her, and I still actively parent her in the ways that I can. I have often referred to my grief for Eslin as becoming like my representation of her, my child. Like, I mother my grief.
Mm-hmm.
I really, really care for it. And I pay very close attention to it when it needs my attention. I give it my attention. And I keep it close.
So grief is love.
Absolutely.
So that's
absolutely.
She is your grief.
Like, when I think about how the short time that we had her, it is still, without a doubt, worth every second of pain we will experience for the rest of our lives after losing her. Absolutely. I would never trade it. I would have her for the almost 4 years and lose her 1,000 times. Like, it's such a privilege, I feel like, to love somebody so much that you could rip your skin off in the pain of losing them. I honor that place that I'm at now. I'm not scared of it. Like I said, I call it my cave. Like, when I feel everything's getting too much, I'm becoming like psycho mom, yeah, the other kids can't even stand the look of a dish. I want to punch Vinny in the face. Like, I'm like, okay, honey, I think Eslin is calling for you. Like, you need to go spend a bit of time with that pain. Go into the cave. And I know I'm coming out of it. That's the thing that's different now, 6.5 years on, compared to the first couple of years, is I know that intensity wanes. It does not last forever. I don't feel that feeling of wanting to rip my heart out all day, every day. I allow myself to feel it for an hour, you know, 2 hours. I sob. I listen to songs, make me think of her. I watch videos. I look at pictures. And I just go into the dark. And I stay there and I feel it. And it's the most horrific feeling ever. And then at some point, my brain kind of flips a switch and starts to pump in a bit of serotonin and oxytocin and all that stuff. Is like, you've had enough now. You've had enough now. Come to. And I get up, I wipe my face, and I go downstairs and I start, you know, doing the dishes. And I build Lego with the kids and I make a cup of tea and I prep for dinner. And I have found that I'm like, I'm okay to say it now. I'm very proud of my grieving process at this point, because I think I could have gone any number of ways. Mm-hmm. And where I've gone to allows me to still grieve her when it is necessary in that manner of being in that dark cave, and also still properly parent my other children, which is in the end the most important thing that I can do, because I don't get to do that for Eslin anymore. So it's very important that I stay a present parent as much as possible for Mannix and Lucy and whoever this is.
So lovely. You're a great woman.
I think, like, if that's any advice that I can give in the end of all this is yeah, to not be afraid of that process. Mm-hmm. Of actually feeling the depths of it. It's so important. Like, it's so important. It's really the only way through it is to just, like, go in.
Get into it.
Get into it. And that's how you come out. And I find every time I come out of that cave, I feel, like, that little bit stronger. I feel that little bit like she's closer to me again. Because sometimes I, like, get stuck in the day-to-day. And I'll be like, oh, my gosh, it's been, like, 3 months since I had a bad cry. Like, that's crazy. Like, how am I just, like, functioning normally as a human being, as a mother, as a parent, when I've gone through this? But that's the way that I do it. Mm-hmm. is I allow it when it needs to happen. And then I also allow the good. I allow the joy. I allow the hope. Like I said, that those first couple of years, I would have been happy to end it.
In the cave.
Yeah, stay in the cave forever, or dive off the cliffs, go join her. I would have been fine to do that. I wasn't scared at all of dying. Mm. Now I want to live a very, very long life. I want to watch my kids grow up, because I didn't get to see her grow up. I want to see everything that they can possibly do. I want to be as old as possible, having had as much time as possible with them. And I'm willing to bear the pain of Eslin's loss through those years to be able to get that experience. I don't want to join her anytime soon. Because I've got her with me in the only way I can now. And I've also got Mannix and Lucy. I've got this last one on the way that we're absolutely delighted to meet. And our family is never going to be complete. Mm. But we're always going to do what we can to have her be in every important moment. And even though there's pain in that all the time, it's the only way forward.
Oh God, that was just, you know, yeah, it's really touching to hear how honest you are and how wise actually you are. Like, you're really wise. You have, and that's what I was feeling. I was feeling you're not scared. You've just not anymore. You've jumped into it,
yeah.
Which is really hard to do because I think that's a lot of people are scared and they run away from it and it's hard. And no wonder, it's horrible. It's like, it's as you said, it's like you want to rip your skin off.
And that running away, like, it affects every aspect of your life. It expects, you know, it affects your relationships, your job, your happiness, your, you know, your ability to enjoy anything. Like, running away from it is like the worst thing you can do. And I remember being very newly into the child support group I went to on Amcara, that I have just the best words to say for.
Yeah, I speak to Karen a lot that does the social media there.
Yeah,
she's lovely.
I absolutely, they just were, it's, there's nothing like finding a group of people who understand. And I remember one of the women who started on Amcara and also lost, she lost a daughter very young, saying to me, it will get better. And I remember being like, I cannot believe she dared to even say these words to me. It's never going to get better. Is she crazy? How, if it gets better, that means that I don't miss her as much or I don't love her as much, or I've gotten over it. Like, I could not even, I was angry to hear those words from a fellow grieving parent.
Yeah.
It felt offensive to me. How could I possibly ever say my life has gotten better? 100% I can say, 6.5 years later, my life has gotten better. And for anyone newly in the process, like, keep doing what you're doing to survive. Like, hold on to the memory of them and just let the hours, the days, the weeks pass. And eventually you will find that you have gotten better at grieving. And you haven't stopped loving that person or missing that person. The pain isn't any less. When you still feel the pain, it's still just as intense. But you're not going to feel it as often, and it's not going to be as controlling in your life. And you will find a way to let joy and hope back in. And, you know, I am not at all jealous of anyone that's like starting new in that journey, particularly, you know, losing a child. Like, and it'll seem like there really is no point in going forward. But I can promise that you, there will come a day that you'll be glad you made it through that bit, because there are other things that you're now enjoying in life. And it does, it doesn't get better, but you just get better at it. You get better at grieving.
So just hold on.
Yeah. Keep going. Keep going. And, you know, I've been very blessed to be able to have other children since losing Eslin. Not every parent gets to have that experience. And so I know everyone has their own unique experience with child loss, and that we have been incredibly lucky to be able to bring more joy into our family. But
oh, Amy, thank you so much for being here and sharing your story with me. I really, really do appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
I think you will really, really help an awful lot of people in all types of loss. Your process of grief and your thoughts on it is just astounding, really. And I'm really grateful to you. And I can't wait to hear the next name.
Me too.
Keep me posted.
I don't know what it's going to be.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me and for letting me talk about Eslin.
I'm sure you will all agree with me. That was just such a powerful conversation. Amy has such a wonderful way with words and being able to articulate just how dark it can be. And the hope that she gives to survive that is really inspiring. Thank you all for tuning in. And as always, if you have enjoyed this conversation, please don't forget to follow, rate, like, comment, share, whatever you can do to get the word out there. Please help us to keep this podcast going. And I really appreciate your support. Talk to you next time.